It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's great to have you with us. With the 2020 school year set to begin in just a couple of weeks, the Trump administration is pushing to fully reopen schools for in-person learning and is threatening to withhold money from districts that won't reopen in the fall. But the heated debate over how and whether to reopen schools is really being fought at the state level. In California, where there are nearly 390,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19, Governor Gavin Newsom announced new rules on Friday that would require most schools to teach remotely this fall.
Learning remains non-negotiable, but neither is the safety of all of our cohorts of support staff as well as our children.
In Florida, which has become an epicenter of the pandemic, Governor Ron DeSantis had this to say over the weekend about reopening schools in his state.
The science on that is just overwhelming. Yes, they're at almost zero risk, but even more than that, transmission from an elementary school to an adult is extremely rare.
We'll talk about the science of transmission from kids to adults in just a moment. But since those remarks, the Florida Teachers Union announced it would sue the DeSantis administration for pushing to fully reopen schools by the end of August. And we've been hearing from teachers across the country about how they're feeling about returning to the classroom.
This is Craig from Dunedin, Florida. I am a high school teacher. I have two children of my own in elementary school, and I'm also a law student at night. My main concern with the public school system is that the plan, as I like to call it, is business as usual with masks. We won't be having social distancing. We can't. There's not enough space.
This is Jill from Conover, North Carolina. I am a public school teacher, and I teach elementary technology for kindergarten through fifth grade students. I'm willing to return to work with face-to-face teaching only if the state and local COVID infection rate is at or below the level when remote construction was implemented. I feel like going back right now is just foolish.
We'll keep hearing from teachers and school staff this week, and in a little bit, we'll hear from two teachers about their stories. And you, of course, can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. But first, I spoke with Apoorva Mandavili, a science reporter from the New York Times who covers school reopenings, about just how schools across the country are planning to tackle this right now.
I think the question of whether to reopen schools and when to do it depends a lot on the level of transmission within the communities. And so the regions that are seeing an uptick in cases, for example, in California, are definitely making some decisions to step back on the idea of reopening schools in person and really just thinking about remote learning. But it's really kind of a patchwork at the moment, because even in Florida, for example, where the state as a whole is really struggling to contain the outbreak, Broward County is thinking about remote learning, but many other counties are not. So it almost seems like a decision that's being left up to individual school districts rather than very well thought out policy for an entire state or for an entire region.
Here in New York, and I can only speak for New York because we're still getting daily briefings from Governor Cuomo, there's really been a back and forth between Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Cuomo about when and how to proceed with opening the schools. No surprise that the two of these gentlemen have often not gotten along, but at the end of the day, it was really Governor Cuomo who said that he had the final word. Are we seeing governors issuing, based on what you just told us, I mean, are there governors really starting to take control of the situation, or most folks not as like Governor Cuomo, I should say?
I think some governors are trying to take control. I think Governor of Florida did try to take control, but within the state, there are still school districts that are saying, you know what, I don't think we're ready to go back to school. And the same with, you know, California. Governor Newsom came out and said on Friday they wouldn't be opening schools wholesale, but I think individual districts will have to still make that decision, and they have a sort of watch list system to see how the districts are doing and communities are doing in terms of containing the outbreak. I think in New York, most of the state is doing very well, and we've been hovering around a 2% positivity rate, the sort of percent of cases that test positive. And that's a pretty good sign. And I think it would be okay to open schools here, as long as, of course, we take all of the precautions, the social distancing, the masks, the hand hygiene. And I think a lot of schools are thinking about opening schools for just part of the week, 2 or 3 days a week, and then doing remote. There are all kinds of combinations being considered.
You recently wrote a piece in the New York Times, Apoorva, where you talked to a panel of scientists who recommended that young students should go back to school. What are some of the benefits to opening schools in the fall for in-person classes?
I think for young kids and for kids who have disabilities, online learning is just not a feasible option in the long term. They just don't learn very well. And they don't have the attention that it takes to sit still for that many hours without a teacher guiding them. It's a huge burden on the working parents. And there's been already some reports that they are falling behind. And falling behind even for a few months at these young ages can have lifetime consequences in terms of their employment, their learning overall. And so I think the panel thought about all of those things. And very importantly, they also considered the risks to the young kids themselves and concluded that in the case of kids who are elementary school age, the benefits of going to school in person outweigh the risks.
Now, those are benefits for the students, but there are other people involved in this equation, namely the teachers and other folks who work in schools, the cleaning staff, the maintenance staff, the school cafeteria staff, the administrative workers, and of course, the parents who are sending their kids to school. Those are the folks that are very concerned, for the most part, about getting and contracting COVID-19 or the coronavirus. Tell us what happens there. I mean, you've spoken to teachers.
Teachers are rightfully extremely nervous. I think some a third of the teachers, full-time teachers in the country, are older than 50, and about a third of school principals are over 55, and those are groups that are at very high risk of severe outcomes from being infected with the coronavirus. And more than half of these teachers and administrators have said in surveys that they are very nervous about going back to school. And of course, as you said, just because the kids themselves don't get sick doesn't really mean that they won't bring the infection back home to parents or grandparents and keep the chain of transmission going in the community. So that's why it's so important to not just think about schools opening in a vacuum, but to think about what else is happening in the community. If a particular community has done a very good job of keeping the virus in check and it's doing a good amount of testing and a good amount of contact tracing and there's enough PPE available for teachers and other staff, then sure, the risks will be minimal. But without all of that kind of planning and without being able to say, for example, that the schools will be able to provide hand hygiene, they'll be able to provide masks, they'll be able to make sure that the kids stay some distance from each other during recess or lunch, it's a really big gamble.
A couple things I want to address there, because, I mean, any of us who have been around young children, particularly elementary school children, know they are full of energy. And while, yes, they can take direction, I think this type of direction is going to be a challenge to wear masks and keep social distance. I mean, how are schools going to ensure that?
Yeah, that's a big question. And if you do need to enforce these things, if you do need people to remind kids that they need to do these things, and you need enough staff to make sure that you have enough staff for kids if you're separating them and keeping them at a distance, you're going to need a lot more teachers than you have now. And already with many teachers saying they may not come back to school because they're afraid, I'm not really sure how the staffing situation is going to work.
I'm also wondering about liability. We've got to be honest about this. I mean, the risk is not zero. And yes, to your point that there are cities and states, among them New York right now, that have managed to flatten the curve, but the virus is still with us and we're seeing peaks across the country as travel continues. We have no idea what the fall will bring. And that leads me to wonder what happens if a student or a teacher gets sick. What happens if that person dies or that student dies? I mean, these are real questions that have to be answered. Do schools have a plan for how to deal with that?
I mean, those are excellent questions, and those are exactly the questions that schools need to be asking themselves before they decide whether to open. I mean, a lot of people have been looking to foreign countries, you know, countries in Europe who have managed to open schools and not have things go really south. But those schools have also all done it very differently. You know, in Germany, once a student is infected, they sent only the classmates and teachers of that student home, but kept the rest of the schools open. In Israel, they closed the schools even after a single case. So it really, there's no one answer to this. And this is something that schools have to think about. And they also have to think about the broader communities. One of the things that I really liked about that panel that you mentioned that I wrote about is that they said every school district has to look at everything in the community, not just the community transmission, although that's a big part of it, but how able are the kids in that community to be able to do remote learning? Is there enough good internet access? Do the kids have access to computers? Will the schools be able to provide them if they don't? And if the answers to those are no, and online learning is a no-go for a particular area, then their calculation is going to be a little bit different than, say, a part of the country where, you know, everybody has great internet access and all the kids have access to iPads and laptops.
Apoorva, one of the things that we know historically, teachers in this country are often strapped for resources. We know that teachers have had to often buy their own supplies for the students that they teach. How is that going to work if teachers also have to have PPE, personal protective equipment, for themselves and for their students?
It can't. I think without funding from states and from the federal government, we're just not going to be able to have the schools be safe enough. One statistic that really struck me is that something like 50% of the school districts have schools that are in dire need of modernizing their buildings. And 40% have ventilation systems that are really outdated. So when we have schools in that shape and we don't have the resources that the school districts themselves can just suddenly modernize, we absolutely need state and federal governments to step in.
Apoorva, we've been talking so far about younger children, elementary school children, but you found some interesting data that shows that older children actually can transmit the virus similar to adults. Is that right?
That's right. There was a study that just came out from South Korea where they did some very careful contact tracing, and they concluded that kids between 10 and 19 transmit the virus just as efficiently as adults do. Now, there are some limitations to this study. We can't just take it wholesale. For example, 10 to 19 is kind of a strange grouping of age, but there is accumulating evidence that kids above 12 behave like adults for this virus, and it's not really fully clear why. It does suggest, though, that elementary school kids are probably much less likely to transmit, roughly about half as likely. That's the number that's been sort of emerging from many studies, but that it may not be as safe for middle and high school kids to go back to in-school learning.
And of course, not just the kids, but the workers in those schools. Apoorva, we've seen schools in other countries have already begun to open. Other countries have also taken precautions much more seriously, and that includes the wearing of face masks for many citizens. Is there an example where the United States can even think about catching up to at this point in terms of best practices that you've noticed across the world?
The problem there, Tanzina, is that the countries that have managed to successfully open schools are all in places that the virus is at very low levels. It's really hard to directly compare the United States to those. Having said that, there are lessons we can get from it. For example, you were mentioning earlier that it's really hard for young kids to wear masks. But in fact, many countries have actually managed to get their young kids to wear masks all day and learn how to do it. They're also doing outdoor learning. I've seen these lovely photographs of, you know, kids in Italy sitting outside at these big tables really set apart, and the teachers are far away from them also. So anywhere where the weather cooperates, we might be able to think about having outdoor learning for kids at least some of the time. In Germany and in Denmark and in Norway, they capped the number of students per class so that in any given class, there would only be 10 or maybe 15 kids. That's obviously very different from how most public schools in America operate. So that's something we would have to think about. And if schools close high schools, if they say high school students should learn from home, maybe all of that high school space could be used to make sure that elementary school kids are spread apart enough. So there are some things we could think about.
Apoorva Mandavili is a science reporter at the New York Times. Apoorva, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
My name is Pat. I'm from Bernardsville, New Jersey, though I do not teach there. The district in which I teach has decided to separate students into two separate cohorts, a Monday-Tuesday cohort and a Thursday-Friday cohort. Wednesday, all students will be taught virtually. When I teach one cohort, the other cohort will be watching and being taught virtually. My biggest concern is that it's going to have to, by needs, socially distance me from all of my neighbors and my family, especially my 93-year-old mother, because I want to limit access to anyone who might contract COVID from me or from my students.
Hi, this is Chris from Martinez, California. My wife is actually a school teacher, and her district has decided to stay with online learning for the fall. And we shall see what goes from there. I'm sure the decision comes from a lack of a plan to do something safe for all parties concerned.